Okay, so welcome to Fed Bites episode 3. I am Yoav Gunbar, tech lead here at Fiverr. With me, as always, my
I gotta apologize. My voice is how you say it is cracked or cracking.
High pitch.
Yeah. So I apologize if I sound like I'm going through puberty in this episode.
Yeah, it's his bar mitzvah time.
Yeah.
So this is Roman.
Yeah, my name is Roman. That's it. Yeah.
The Sandler man.
Yeah, Roman Sandler.
Also an engineer here at Fiverr. We work together at FiverrX, which is a kind of startup company within Fiverr. Mm-hmm. And today we are joined by Pavel. I'm sorry, I don't know how to exactly pronounce your last name.
Duchovny.
Duchovny. Almost like David Duchovny.
Well, we have same origins from like same Ukraine, you know, places.
Kind of a hot topic nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, we won't go there, but yeah, just to mention David Duchovny.
Yeah. We'll just say we stand with Ukraine and let's keep it at that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, so today tell us a little bit about what you do. Where do you work at?
All right, so I'm employed at MongoDB for the last more than six years now. I'm based in Tel Aviv, and we have a growing team here. I'm coming from the database world, so I've done DevOps and database data engineering over relational, NoSQL, cloud, non-cloud databases. So yeah.
Cool, very cool.
And also some development around, like, you know, web development and that stuff.
But you'd say your passion is like databases and working with data mostly?
I would say that everything that makes an application cool with data is something that I'm passionate about.
Cool. So yeah, a little disclosure. I kind of met Pavel at a meetup, Node.js, a few years back. And we kind of connected back then. And I just kind of leveraged that connection through LinkedIn and just shouted out to him and trying to get him on Twitter a little bit, because you just went on Twitter. So
people. Yeah, I'm not super active there. Yeah, but yeah, I'm trying.
Yeah, it's where everybody's at now. That's what everybody's saying. You know, so hopefully we'll get you on there and give us a follow also. Yeah,
we're trying. I'll do.
So anyway, we kind of wanted to ask you on the show because the application we're working with is using MongoDB, and we're using MongoDB Atlas, and like myself and Roman, I think as well, kind of been mostly doing like web development and front end development, full stack. Here and there, like what we're doing right now is full stack, but like for me, like my expertise is more in the front end. So I usually like whatever, get me the data and I'll like render it somehow nicely and filter it if I don't need anything. And
so, I have more of a traditional background with like PHP and the SQL databases. So I'm very used to thinking in a relational kind of structure.
Yeah. So I used to work with MongoDB back in like a different startup I was at, but then again, like we didn't have too many complex relationships between things. So we just used to store documents and just pull them and push them basically. Yeah. But nowadays with the applications we're working at, we kind of find ourselves having a little bit more to connect between like different collections and documents, and kind of trying to figure out what is the exact way that we should go about this. So we kind of started thinking about, are we doing things the right way? Like, how are we supposed to do this? Are we supposed to populate this? Are we supposed to kind of use a virtual field and render it and the data like that? So that's why we reached out and thought it would be interesting for us and our audience to kind of learn a little bit more in depth.
Yeah. So
our 15 person audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully that'll grow.
Yeah. So I think the key word you mentioned there was like relationships. And I think this is the widest misconception about MongoDB is that a lot of people say it's a non-relational database. And I don't like this kind of definition. So I think it's more non-tabular. That's my go-to word. I think there's a lot of relationships within MongoDB data and collections. We just need to form them correctly for what we need, basically. So there's a lot of methodologies to think about when you kind of like designing your schema for MongoDB, and you should design your schema, because if you just treat it like I heard people saying schemaless database, that you just dump everything within it, then it might work, but then you might hit like a dead end somewhere, and you know, now modifying you know, terabytes of data is not a pleasant thing to do. So definitely you should design a schema. It can be a flexible schema. And we can talk about what a flexible schema means. Mm-hmm. When I approached, and I do it a lot in my current position, so I didn't mention it, but I work with the most strategic customers of MongoDB within our developer relations department. Mm-hmm. So I'm basically trying to inspire them to use MongoDB correctly.
So this is exactly why you're here.
Yeah.
You're trying to so maybe a little bit like for maybe the less versed people that are listening to us, and hopefully we can teach some people that have less experience. What I want to ask, like a few like really basic questions about MongoDB.
All right.
Just to start off kind of the conversation. And again, this is in no type kind of to kind of just to try and educate, I guess. So I'd say, like, at first, why should like a developer or any product kind of look at MongoDB and choose it as their database over like a relational, classical relational database like SQL or PostgreSQL? And for the matter of fact, like, what is the key benefits that Mongo has over them?
All right, so we usually pitch like, why not? So I think that, you know, you should approach it with why not to consider MongoDB, because MongoDB is a general purpose database. This is where we actually position ourselves as a data platform now. Mm-hmm. To allow even more robust abilities than just a database. But you know, we can do different type of workloads, very, very different. So we can do transactional workloads, we can do graph workloads, we can do analytical workloads, we can do text searches. And I think that, you know, once you have this or time series, like new features that we have now, so you can actually insert time series data and it will be optimized for time series. And we can talk about time series and explain what it is later on. But basically, you know, if you can have transactions, analytics, aggregations, and store it within a format that your application expects and your classes are expecting the data to be mm-hmm. in, that's a win-win, basically. So that's why I think you should consider MongoDB, because it actually makes much more sense for an application than probably to a human being eyes. So... What I will tell you is, like, humans are easier to kind of like process data within tables. And that's natural. We see Excel and it makes more sense for us. But applications are not humans. Right. Applications have a different perception. So we want to have, like, you know, a simple way we can define relationships and get all the data that we need within this block and maybe sometimes change the, you know, the way our class is treating the data basically on the properties that we get back. And this is where the what we call the document model is so effective, that you can define everything as a document, mm-hmm. And MongoDB can have different fields within a document. And if your application knows how to process that, then you can have very different documents within a single collection. So somebody can have, you know, hobbies that are related to sports. So we need some, you know, data related to sports, and it can be in one format. And someone has hobbies to create like aircrafts. And there's a total different set of fields, but they can all still be living within this same kind of like main object.
Well,
the festival, right, but like no one wants to do that, right? Yeah. Like you don't, when you're working on an application, you don't want to be like checking every, let's say that you have, let's take the boring like posts, comments, you know, model. You don't want to be checking everywhere. Does this post, the document have this property or doesn't it? Right? Like you, that's why I think like we tend, I would bet that most people using Mongo use, you know, the same strict schema that they do with SQL, because from a developer's perspective, you just want to, you know, you just want to work with, you know, some sort of an object that has
a structure. I want to know like what I'm getting. So wouldn't like saving different documents in a collection, like different structures of documents, like be a little bit unwieldy at some point, you know what we're saying?
I mean, I would do that for like logs and shit, right? Like if you have like, let's say you have like, you use Mongo for like logging, right? Then I don't care, right? Because I'm not looking at logs. I'm just outputting them out. So I don't care, right? Yeah. If like log has the same properties as the ones that, you know, were logged like a month ago, I don't care. But if I'm working with Mongo sort of to build whatever, like a website, a web app, whatever you want to call it, I want like my post model to be deterministic, you know, in some way. I want to know, right, I can have some, you know, some optional properties on that document.
Exactly.
But essentially, I want it to be pretty prefixed, right? So I think the example of like, you know, I agree with you on what you said earlier of like, you know, you should model your data, right? You shouldn't use, your main database, right, as like this schemaless, you know, dump of data, right? Nobody wants to do that. So that example of like, you know, one document can look this way and another document can look another way, I don't think that's very like relevant to the conversation around like how using Mongo as your main database. You know what I mean?
Well, I would say that, you know, people tend to get to extremes. They think like when you say something, like every field needs to be that way. But I say like the hybrid solution sometimes is the golden path. So it's like I have my mandatory fields, which I know will be there. And, you know, I can enforce it with, you know, schema validation, which we have in the database. Or I can make sure that, you know, my data access layer, like, actually, you know, inputs the fields and there's no mistakes in this area. But the thing is, we allow the flexibility for the developer to decide what he wants to do.
So
for some modules, for some areas, sometimes you would want to check for a property. And if it exists, maybe you want to go to a certain path.
I'm just
and
saying, the fact that, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I mean, the fact that we do allow this is a powerful thing.
Absolutely.
You can always block it, or even on the database level.
Right.
But I think that the conception of just thinking about it as a SQL database won't get you far. That's what I'm saying.
That's an interesting topic to get into, because that's probably our biggest conversation here. I just wanted to say about the optional fields that, you know, even usually, right, when working with relational databases, I'll have optional fields basically in every table, right?
Yeah, you'd have it under null, like.
Yeah, I'll just have to.
Which is pretty wrong for a SQL design database. So, you know, you're creating blotted tables, what we call, is that you have a lot of tables that have those empty spaces, and eventually you hit them with performance, right? Your indexes, like if you index a certain field and most of it is null, either it won't be indexed or some databases actually index null fields. So that's an even worse situation. Let me give you an example. So I like to talk about examples. So I was talking to this community user, actually, like not a big application. They do a delivery of like milk and essential, you know, groceries to older people now during COVID. So more and more people actually use applications. And one of the things is, you know, sometimes I would want to do kind of like it's not extraordinary. I would say it's some extra groceries or some extra conditions that I want to add for a specific delivery for a specific time. So you can actually input an optional field now. You can actually edit for the specific subscription of this person. Like, I have an exception over this dates to this dates. And once, you know, your application fetches the data, it can suddenly see, okay, I have an exception for those dates and act differently. And it's much easier than, you know, doing all this conditional querying on your data access layer, understanding, like in a SQL database, I'll probably have another table with like exceptional, you know, entry, and I need to go and do another query, and it all gets much more complex.
Okay, now, right. I'm curious. You were talking about how would you kind of define a schema for like a new application on Mongo? Like, I think one of the key benefits for Mongo and one of the reasons that was chosen for our project right here was that it's very flexible, right? So when you're building new products, you don't exactly know how you're kind of model is going to be
structured. I mean, that's kind of bullshit. That's not really the reason.
Yes and no, really, right.
Most people don't choose a database, but for the right reasons.
Usually, right? They go with what they know, right?
Right. That's, I mean, or whatever.
Most of us, we choose tools by what we know and what's easiest for us to kind of approach. And yeah, that is. However,
this is why developer relations is so important, because because developers today deciding what technology they're gonna use, and if we're gonna, you know, teach them how to use technology that is better for them, then they'll probably use it. That's the fact.
It's all about coming back to my dev FOMO. Like, did I choose the wrong thing? Is there something better out there?
Yeah.
Right. So, well, back to kind of my point. So sometimes you don't exactly know how to structure your schema completely, I'd say. And on the topic of schemas also, like, we use Mongoose to this kind of our ORM layer. And you're smiling. You can't see, but Pavel is smiling and kind
smirking.
I don't really super like this framework, but yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Ahead. Interesting.
Let's put a pin in that.
Let's put a pin in that. But I find that like something. Well, we'll get to why I also dislike Mongoose a little bit.
The main problem I see with Mongoose is, first of all, it's not a MongoDB product. Not a lot of people know that, but it's a third party product. It's widely used, so it's very popular. I see the charm that it gives, like that you define a schema and then you have your model, and then you kind of like, you know, you just need to specify this model and everything gets populated, everything looks beautiful and shiny. The problem is that it actually, you know, kind of like puts you in that box that, you know, your schema is very structured upon your models, and you cannot, like, dealing with exceptions in Mongo seems like a bigger problem than just using the Node.js driver. And also, the Mongoose is, it's an object to document mapping, kind of like, I would say a framework. And the funny thing is that we see documents as objects, and, you know, it's mapping an object to an object. So you're just adding a layer to do like maybe an unnecessary work.
Yeah,
in a way.
Unnecessary abstractions somewhere.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And also you always need for the Mongoose library to be aligned with whatever, you know, your database server is. And, you know, since they're another kind of like foundation, we do help them because they're so popular, but it's not always aligned like in super slick as our drivers. So I'm really trying to inspire developers to try the Node.js driver and maybe try to use just the Node.js driver instead of using Mongoose.
So that would be your recommendation, is kind of going with the Node.js driver?
I think it's not really comparing, like, it's not really apples to apples, right? I mean, using the native driver is sort of like using a query builder in the SQL world, right? It's not really comparable to an ORM, right? Because what you're really looking for in an ORM, right, is a model layer, essentially, on top of your application.
What I'm saying is, with MongoDB, you don't need an ORM because the database is an ORM already. Hmm. But you know it.
How about generating types from that though? For TypeScript, that would be great. Like, like something we've come across by using Mongoose right now, right? And what we have is Mongoose. We're defining our schema. Then we need to define the types of our TypeScript types according to our Mongoose schema. I still haven't found, maybe you know something that I don't know. We still haven't found kind of something that generates TypeScript types on the fly or just co-generates it. And maybe we can learn something there, but what is kind of the way that you would recommend going about getting types for type safety?
Yeah. So I need to double check that because I've never kind of like looked into that honestly, but I think that you know we have this what we call the extended JSON protocol, or I don't know if it's like I think it's a protocol, I don't know, but is that you can get your the result from the Node.js driver with an extra field for the type.
Hmm.
You're talking about like a JSON schema? I know you can put a JSON schema in your Atlas.
I know that extended JSONs look like if you get a date, so there's a dollar date and then the value. So the actual value you get back is like an object where there's a dollar date and a string representing that date. So you know it's a date.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting how you work exactly with TypeScript. I can look it up and I can you know follow up later on. Yeah, we can have another episode just on TypeScript.
Yeah, I didn't mean to stump you there, but I thought like
yeah.
It's something that's I think one of my biggest pain points right now is
All right.
The way we're working is like I want to know like what exactly am I getting back, you know? Because at the end of the day, that's nowadays like the industry has kind of adopted and made TypeScript their little like love child and everybody.
Yeah, no, I see where maybe an ORM can have some benefits. I can look up a great like blog about like Mongoose versus the Node driver. And I think it's also related to TypeScript as I remember, but I don't remember the entire content. So I can send it to you. And once we publish, we can add this as
amazing. That would be great.
The Mongoose experience is also like not great in terms of TypeScript because you sort of need to define an interface in TypeScript. And then you sort of tell Mongoose, this model needs to sort of adhere to this interface, but you still need.
I don't think it like completely stricts it and makes it.
You still need to define all the fields using, you know, Mongoose's schema definition.
It's not like
tool, right?
You don't do it once and get like all the benefits of the type system.
Yeah. So I wonder if like there's some tricks that, you know, a lot of people use, which are, you know, just avoiding using Mongoose and can achieve the same kind of like mapping this interface to a Node.js driver. But, you know, let's talk about the schema design itself, because I think that's the interesting part. And you've asked me, I think before, like 3 or 4 minutes ago, like, what do I do when I approach a schema design?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that there's three things that I think about. First is what are the players? Like what are the players that are gonna approach the application?
Mm-hmm.
And how would they want to see the data? So if we talk about like, you know, if it's like a pharmacy or a medical application, so we'll probably have doctors, patients, I don't know, maybe some medical staff and some laboratory people. So, you know, we need to understand who's gonna approach the data and how they want to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we need to understand like how are they going to access it, like whether a patient is going to see first, you know, all of his future appointments, their prescriptions, and by that understand how we're going to map the data in our appointments collection.
Mm-hmm.
So both doctors and patients needs to think about appointments, because one needs to attend an appointment and needs to know that somebody is coming, and the other one. So they're probably going to share this document, and we need to understand like what are the identifiers we need to place in each of those documents. Second thing is something I heard from Elliot Horowitz, which was the co-founder and the CDO of MongoDB for the last, I mean, he's not in the company right now, but yeah, he's one of the co-founders, and I met him a lot of times, and I liked something that he said, like, you need to think about, you know, think about real stuff when you design MongoDB objects. Like, you know, when we have this classic SQL, you know, there's the departments and employees and, you know, salary collections, right? Mm-hmm. So what's a department? Department is not really a real thing. It's just a bunch of employees that have a specific tag to them. Yeah. So does departments really deserve a collection? Or we can say for every employee, like, you know, what is your department? And this is what defines like what a department is. It's all the employees that have like the tag for this department. Mm-hmm. And since MongoDB is also have those complex objects like arrays, so if you are within three departments at the same time, it's not a common thing, but you can still have an array of your department, you know, tags, right? So I can be in, you know, in finance, and I can maybe I'm super talented, so I'm also in engineering. So I can have both fields, I mean, both values within an array. I can index that, and I can search on that. So that's a very powerful thing. So, you know, thinking about, you know, what is really my objects? What are objects in reality? Like, for example, a lot of, like a team, for example, a team is a bunch of people. So if I already save people's information, I should probably tag them with the team ID. Mm-hmm. And I'd have a team collection that honestly only kind of connects people to a team. And the third thing I'm thinking about when I'm designing is, you know, how I'm gonna access the data. So if I need to do pagination for this data, mm-hmm. And there's going to be a lot of data that I need to paginate, it doesn't make sense to fit it within one document, right? So it makes sense to kind of have an identifier that I can query quickly and get a bunch of like a cursor of documents that I can iterate over. And maybe I need to, I don't know, skip or limit some of the documents. So also this kind of like thinking is what also leading me to define whether I'm going to embed data, I'm going to keep it in separate documents.
Okay. And it's funny, you mentioned embedded documents. So like, when would you go ahead and embed a document within another? Like, what's the best practice for that?
I mean, embedding is kind of a relationship, right? It's like we have a parent data and we have this child data. So if we have a parent to child kind of relationship, it makes sense to embed the data, but we need to be very careful that we not hit one of the anti-patterns. And we have a huge article, and I can also, you know,
you're talking about the large document anti-pattern.
Large document, something that we call unbounded arrays, which is very bad. So if you have an array that can grow enormously, that's a bad practice. Don't go there. Even if it fits the 16 megabyte limit of a MongoDB document. Mm-hmm. The problem with huge arrays is when you operate on arrays, the way the server does it, it needs to kind of, I'll say serialize and deserialize those arrays when it operates on them. And it's first of all, it's a huge CPU cost. Second, it's a huge hazard on the developer because, you know, there are different errors that you can get, like conflicts within updating the same array with different values. So if you keep your arrays as a small kind of like constructive, you know, embedded data. Mm-hmm. For example, I have my medicines, right? I have my prescription. I'll probably have like a tens of them, right? I won't have like if I have thousands of prescriptions, that doesn't make sense, or I'm or I'm super sick, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. But so would you save like the I don't know, say like prescription type or the pill type or like the object of whatever represents kind of the prescription you're getting? Or would you say I'm saving just an array of IDs for the prescription? And then you'd go, and if you need to actually know what that prescription is, you'd go and find it by the ID and populate it.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So, you know, storing just the ID means that for every query I'm doing and I need to fetch this data, I will need to do either a lookup or another query to fetch the other items from the other collection.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually makes me think, like, what is the scenario that I will need to fetch the profile, my profile, and then, you know, I have something on my screen. So I'll probably need to show some more information, right? Maybe the at least the, I don't know, maybe the medicine name, mm-hmm. right? I don't need to put in a full, like, you know, description of what this medicine does and like how many times I need to. I just need to place maybe another identifier that I can populate within my screen to a user. Mm-hmm. And he's going to say, okay, I want to look at Acamol, okay? And once he clicks Acamol, then we take that ID that he clicked on and then we go to the other collection. So, right. So instead of embedding just the ID, I've embedded another thing that's probably not going to change, right? The name of the name of the medicine is not going to change. I mean, maybe the order of the medicines can change, and we have operators that you can actually shuffle things within an array once it's updated. But I would say, like, I'm a big fan of what we call the extended reference pattern, which is
when you
reference another collection, but you don't only embed the IDs, but you also embed information that makes sense to get within this initial query. Like, I don't know, the names of the name of the prescription and the dates that it was prescribed for me. Those things are not going to change, right? Over time.
Isn't that like data duplication a little bit? If you already have
saying, because it's not going to change.
It is, but it's not going to change, right? The date that somebody's prescribed something to me is not going to change. So even if the prescription amount is changing over time,
mm-hmm.
the date that was first prescribed did not change. Now, here is where it's sometimes a bit complex, is if we want to also show, for example, when we got, you know, updated. When the data was updated. So here we can either use kind of like a, you know, if a two-phase commit is a good definition, but we can either use things like change streams. So whenever we change something within our prescription, we catch this change via a feature we call change streams. And when we can catch the ID of the, you know, the specific user prescription and go and update this small extended array with those new dates.
Now, change streams, is that like kind of events that actually go and update? That's like computed values or observables.
Yeah, but we do it every time for just this single change that happens. So it's always like a key value fetches and updates. So that should be pretty efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if the arrays are massive, you'll see that it's not efficient. That's why we say, you know, don't go over, you know, I don't know if there's a number, but I would say, like, if you have more than 500 members in an array, you need to kind of think, what is going on here? Why is it growing this fast? Yeah,
maybe you put it then in the collection. It should be a collection.
Then we have something we call the outlier pattern. I can send all those known patterns that we have.
Amazing. So, well, that'll be great. We'll put them in the show notes.
So the outlier pattern is interesting, is when you know that, you know, most of your users will have, you know, a few elements,
mm-hmm.
but there are those users that have this outlier, right? For example, let's take Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a lot of people that have, I don't know, have 100,000 followers, right? But there's like a few people that have 40 million,
right?
Or 50 or 400. I don't know. Maybe there's like 2-3. So those are considered outliers, and we need to kind of treat those outliers maybe in a separate, you know, world. And they are so unique that, you know, designing the application to fit most of the users will work with, you know, let's say having 1,000 followers in an array, and then the next 1,000 goes into a follow-up document where we kind of have a linked list, right? We can save the idea of the next document. Mm-hmm. And we can always have a master document where we increment the number of followers. So in the master document, we know how many followers there are. And we can have in this document the first, you know, the first kind of batch that you show if you click the followers button and you want to see the first one, you know, the first followers, the join. But then you probably have a pagination where you would, you know, fetch the as the user scrolls or click like load more. You're gonna fetch other documents, but then there's those persons that actually have those huge amount of data. So for example, let's think about, I don't know if you know, like Cristiano Ronaldo has like a huge amount of followers. Maybe I will have a collection called Cristiano Ronaldo in my database just for this user, because he needs like a total different like approach because he's so uniquely.
I want to dig into this.
Yeah, topic. Yeah. I was just about to.
Let's just dig into this topic real, because I think it's the most. This is like, to me, it's like the core of the discussion. This is the most, you know, controversial, most interesting part to talk about. So let's sort of try and dive into this. Okay. I think just to set the stage, right? We're developers. What we care about is developer experience, right? I mean, most of the time, I think that's what drives most developers.
And developer experience or user experience?
Like developer experience.
Okay.
We want to have a good time maintaining our application. That's like what drives us. What, right? That's like the main reason.
At least you're honest.
Absolutely.
We're all about honesty.
Yeah.
Like, again,
yeah.
I do.
It's developer experiences equals kind of better user experience usually. No, but
I do. Obviously, we care about user experience because that's what we get paid for, right?
Yeah.
But like, if we're talking about like yourself, like what drives you as like a person, right? I think that most of us as developers, we want to have a good time. We want to have a good time maintaining, you know, the project that we're working on. So especially like in our case, we're like a brand new product. We're, you know, we're not talking about scale. We don't really, at this point, performance is not like a thing. We don't want to optimize for performance at this point. I mean, for us, and I think for probably a lot of developers, right? Performance is not necessarily like a bottleneck. If you're talking about Fiverr.com, the website, right? It's at a point where you really, really understand the patterns and the way your users use your platform, and you have humongous, you know, sets of data, and that is a different ball game altogether, right? In terms of like schema design. If we're talking about like you're just starting off a project, right? Let's say that the product is still like probably, you know, 90% of projects, and for us, right? The product is still like, you're still figuring it out, right? The relationships are constantly changing. The players are changing, and your data model is fairly, you know, you have little data, right? You don't have like hundreds of thousands of users or whatever. So I think for me, you know, I really dug deep once in the moment that I got into MongoDB. Because I have very traditional background with frameworks like Laravel and Rails, where they were very, very convention based around like relational, you know, databases. I really dug deep into the, you know, MongoDB sort of, you know, patterns and recommendations and, you know, all the, I try to, you know, read and watch as much as possible. And I keep getting like things that are very similar to what you're talking about now, right? Think about how your user, right, interacts with the data. Think about like how your data is being like read, optimized for, you know, your specific use case. But like the thing is that, you know, we don't have enough for us, it's not we don't have enough information to really do that, right? It's not like we can sort of observe the behavior of our users and be like, okay.
Can you imagine it? At least, can you imagine it?
What?
Can you imagine?
I can imagine it, but from my experience, I would be mostly wrong, right? Like as a developer, I would be mostly wrong.
That's the nice thing about flexible schema is that if you're wrong, it's a bit easier to fix that. And you can have this model where you read one document type and you write it differently because you understand that you need to have data differently, and you can have in your data model. I know that it's not a it might be a bit of a strain on the developer to maintain this, but you can have you can go through two filters. One is I have my old way I'm working with data, and I'm transitioning to the new one. And if I'm reading the new version, I might treat the data differently, and then gradually migrate the documents to work better in the future. So it's kind of like a rollout. Changing your schema,
right.
And this is, and I truly understand that. And I have a nice story about it, which was when COVID started. So we had this this interesting customer who's done this remote education platform. How convenient! But they've developed it before COVID. So they they design everything, all the microservice, everything based on what they thought it will be, right? Like, who needs a remote educational system? Like, there's going to be 500, 700 users. And when COVID hit, they said, okay, we have the product to do that, right? Like, how cool, like we can drive revenue. Here is our application. And users started to use that. And suddenly something broke the system completely. And they just didn't understand. So they kept upscaling the clusters. They were using Atlas. So it's like a press of a button, right? You press, you go from M60 to M80 to M100 to M200. They've reached M400. They had the money to pay for it, but it kept breaking. And they were like, what's happening here? And what they realized is that the developers were like, it was convenient for them to create a class document and have the class chat within this class document. So the chat was basically pushing, messages. So the chat was an array within the class document. Mm-hmm. And they've kept pushing documents. And when COVID hit, you have those, classes of 300 students. And if they want to bomb the chat now, because the lecture is late and it didn't mute the chat. So they've ended up like with few classes having several hundred thousands of messages. And due to the compression of MongoDB, they were allowed to get into this single document. But what it cost to the CPU was like crazy. Right.
That's sort of my beef with embedded documents, because I feel like the recommendation from MongoDB everywhere that I've heard is like embed first, right? Embed unless you have a need to reference, right? But then our typical developer, that's not like an expert on database design, right? On like schema design, goes like, oh, MongoDB told me to embed. So I'm going to take my class and then I'm going to embed the chat in there, right? Instead of sort of, doing it because that's the MongoDB way, right?
Yeah. But I want you, so what my mission is to make you ask yourself three simple questions that you're going to say, like, does the data I'm embed is always needed when I fetch it? Does all the chat messages are needed when I fetch the data? And if you say no, then it doesn't make sense to embed all of them. The second thing is whether I'm going to hit one anti-pattern. And there's five or six. It's like, there's not a huge amount of those anti-patterns, and unbounded arrays is one of them. So if I might hit this situation that my array grows indefinitely for no reason, don't embed. So, when you ask yourself those questions, it will be easier for you to kind of like say, I'm going to embed or not.
Okay. But I want to suggest another approach that I find easier.
Okay.
And you potentially convince me that it is the wrong approach. I want to suggest always reference. Okay. never embed anything until you have a performance bottleneck. And when you do, then think what is the data that you want to, you know, specifically present in that specific use case, and then go ahead and embed it. So, you know, I'm thinking about, like, let's say you have posts and comments, right? Don't embed the comments, reference between them. And then once you have thousands of comments, then think, okay, maybe I just want like the last 30 days of comments.
How would you know that you have a performance problem?
Well, I know. I guess if like my Atlas cluster crashes or the application is slow, you know.
Okay, and what do you think users think then when they hit those situations?
What do they think?
Yeah.
Who's this idiot who built this?
Yeah. What a shitty app. Uninstall.
Yeah, what a shitty app.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a huge impact for businesses. This is a huge impact.
Right.
You know, and I understand that developers want to, you know, have a great time. And I think, you know, it's not that hard to ask yourself those like 5 or 6 questions when you design. And once you do that, you'll see that your life is much easier and you won't hit those, you know, situations where you're like, you know, you're ashamed of what's the result was. And you're going to say like, okay, MongoDB sucks. But it's not exactly that MongoDB sucks. Is that you suck?
Is that you suck?
You suck as a developer. You don't know what you're doing.
It's like always. You're trying to do something, and you're like, this thing is stupid. Ten minutes later, I'm stupid.
So I'm saying, like, you know, it's not that you're not like, and in terms of comments and posts, I would say like it makes sense to not embed them, right? Because there's a big possibility that a lot of posts will have a lot of comments. I mean, even if you are not a super popular application, you know, sometimes users start a discussion there. Like, but the question, how are you going to reference that? That's also a question that I would like to ask, maybe.
So what we've been doing at the beginning, I haven't joined yet, but the guys here, what they did was they sort of had these, you know, ID columns, not columns, like properties, right? So they have, let's say you have posts and comments, so you would have like on every comment, you would have a post ID, right? But right. Now what we started doing is we don't give it the ID suffix, we just call it, you know, post, right? And then typically with Mongoose, we populate the parent if you need it, right? So let's say you fetch a comment, or even the other way around. So a post might have like, you know, comments, which references the comments collection. And if you need, well, that's like a specifically, that's a bad implement. That's like a bad, you know, example, because we would never populate all of the comments, right? Yeah. So we wouldn't want to do that. But, you know, let's say from the comments.
So you're already starting to implement what I taught you in this session. That's which is what is nice,
right?
So definitely embed the post ID in the comments collection.
Mm-hmm. Embed. So what do you mean embed?
I mean embed or refer. I mean call it refer. But I mean take the post ID and place it in the comments collection.
Because yeah. Okay.
There'll be more comments than posts.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The same way that, you know, if we have, let's say we have a building and people that live in that building, there's going to be much more people than buildings.
Right.
So it doesn't make sense to embed the, you know, the human IDs in a building, but it makes sense to embed the building ID in the human collection.
Right.
And also, as you mentioned, you're going to paginate the data, right? So fetching comments based on a filter of a post ID and getting it in a cursor make much more sense.
Right. Absolutely. I think it's just, you know, this is like an easy example, right? But like typically,
but it shows exactly the way you need to think about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's like, I feel like that's not the type of like, that's not the type of dilemmas that we have on a day-to-day, right? Like what we have, like the type of dilemmas that we have is like, let's say you have like an entity, like a user, right? And a user is sort of associated to like
an organization and a company,
let's say like brands, right? And you're sort of thinking, okay, so right now in this specific, what we need is we just need to have the user show up on a screen and have like a little list of the brands that he's associated to. So
how many brands are there?
Let's say there are four for a user. You're thinking it's not too much, right? So if you're trying to think like the Mongo way, right, then what you're going to do is you're going to embed an array of these brands, right? Just strings, like literally like an array of strings in that user document. And then in the UI, you're just going to go like, you know, user.brands, and you're just going to display it on the screen, right? But then what happens is the product person comes in and says like, you know what, this specific brand, right? This is just like a slug, but when you display it to the user, we want to give it like another name. Right. We want to
show the logo.
Oh, we want to show the logo. Or we want to show whatever more information. And then basically like your schema in that moment falls apart. Right. Because it's like you can't add another property. Right. Because you embedded like an array of strings. You understand what I mean?
Yeah. But it doesn't mean that you cannot, have this data somewhere else and then perform, you know, you fetch the user, you get these names, and maybe also embed an ID, like maybe something that is not immutable. Like a name can also change, but if something like
an ID,
and then I go and then I go and fetch it from another smaller collection that has all my brands. It doesn't mean that if I'm embedding the brands within the user collection, I cannot like store it.
Yes. Okay, so that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Roman is just getting validation. You can see it on his face.
No, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I think we're not. When I say embed, I mean embed with no
uniquely
with no identifier.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So what you're talking about here, this is what we call reference, right? Because you're sort of
I'm saying like for a simple use case, use only the embedded data. But if you have a more complex use case, leave yourself a room to kind of do other queries and get like a more rich data that your product people might need. Think about it this way. Like, for example, we have four brands for each person. But then what happens is that, you know, overall we have millions of brands. Okay. So the product comes and says, like, we need a report on all the brands, like how many users do they have? And you know, starting to do those calculations on this huge users collection that might be huge and doing those distinct operations on it doesn't make sense. So if we would store it, you know, in another collection, and we can do that once with, you know, we have the aggregation, the dollar out, the dollar merge operators, that you can actually create another collection smaller for your reports, for the things that you want to do, like for a different workload, and have it stored duplicated. So don't be afraid of duplicating data. Duplicating data is not bad. I know that the SQL mind, the normalization mind is saying like, no, don't do that. But why not? If I know that this data is not updated frequently, I can duplicate it.
But who knows? I don't know.
You don't know, but you know, eventually once you reach the breach, you could probably use some tricks to kind of like, you know, either do a rolling upgrade of your documents as you fetch them. You can get, like, for example, there's a nice trick that I've used for profile pictures. Mm-hmm. So when you have a user, and you know, sometimes we have posts and we have the author, and you know, the author and the profile picture. Mm-hmm. So some people say, like, you know, if I'm gonna embed it in a post document, right? And the person changes this profile picture, right? It can happen. So I need to go now and change all the posts of this user to have this
different profile.
Yeah,
different profile. So either I'm going to add a logic that says, like, you know, for every profile that I'm fetching, if I have a newer profile feature, I'll override it, and it's possible. Mm-hmm. But I can also, you know, from initially store like a generic value, so I can have a user ID docs_logo.png or JPG, and I can embed this data. And whenever a user updates their profile picture, they are actually overriding the this current picture that we save for all the posts and documents. And then once your application fetches the general kind of like JPG path, it will show the latest one.
So, hold on. I didn't get that. So you're saying like a collection of just like images?
No. The images, let's say they are stored on S3 or somewhere that it makes more sense to store like, images.
Yeah, again, you'd
save,
the URL.
Yeah, you're saving the URL, but you're also not saving a URL that the user uploaded the name of the picture, but you're saving it under a general URL. Like for example, the user ID _ main profile picture .jpg.
On what collection are you, on what document are you putting this property on?
From the beginning, when a user registers and it saves his profile picture, it gets a generic name. And this is the name that is getting populated to all the posts or whatever
data the user. Okay, yeah.
And now if a user updates their profile picture, they'll still have an array of profile pictures in their profile document. But the name of the main profile picture will be the same as was posted to all the kind of posts documents. So I'll have a generic name. And then I don't need to update this generic name because it will always be the same. So whenever my application shows the profile within a post, it fetches it from the post document and it sees the generic name and it will always show the latest one that you uploaded for that name, which is your latest profile picture.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of a trick that people always think like, okay, I'm duplicating data, but then if this data changes, then I need to update all those documents. And I'll say like, do you really need to have this uniquely name for that thing? Or that thing can be a general name, which the user doesn't care how the file is named underneath the application, right? He just wants to see the picture of his updated profile. And then it's much easier to manage it that way. Maybe you lost me a little bit.
No. It's kind of confusing, I gotta say. I understand like the motivation to it and how like the general idea of it, but you see, it's kind of a different way of thinking a little bit, I'd say.
Yeah, I think you know, in the Israeli army, we like to talk about the average soldier, right? We all know that. And I like to think about the average developer, and I want to sort of generally, you know, I want to think about I like the phrase meeting the developers where they're at, you know, meaning that like I take the world as it is, not as I want it to be. And I feel like a lot of the times, you know, for me to sort of design like a good schema for Mongo requires a lot of thought and requires sort of a lot of understanding of like patterns and practices. And
but not only that, you also need to understand the business domain and the problem that you're solving, and you need to understand like what are the requirements for the application
and how it's used, and blah blah.
And just the user is gonna use
a lot of times, I feel like it's so much easier for me. I'm really trying to be honest here, right? It's so much easier for me to just normalize the data, right? You know, completely, just do it the same way I would in a relational database. And sort of, you know, not try and really, you know, apply a lot of thought into every, you know, property, every collection that I make. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of developers make such a huge mess of their MongoDB, you know, schemas, is because, you know, it's difficult, right? It's definitely more difficult to come up with these patterns because it's not consistent. As you say, like, right, you need to think about each use case, what's appropriate for that use case, you know, how many users are going to see it, how big is this document going to get, how, you know, do you see more properties added to this document in the future, sort of a lot of questions that you need to be asking yourself, and it's just more difficult, right? And I'm really trying to think that, you know, like, how bad is it, right? Like, how bad is it to go with this approach of like, normalize first? I'm not saying don't embed, right? When you have an appropriate, I'm just saying let's flip it from embed first to reference first, right?
Yeah. But, you know, first of all, it's a misconception that it takes a lot of time. It doesn't really take a lot of time. Think about the life cycle of development, and you'll see that, you know, the session that you need to do in order to think about it, it's not more than 2 hours.
No, I'm not talking about time. I'm talking about, like, you know, just like the level of, you know,
difficulty. Yeah. So I say it's not difficult. Once you follow a simple set of rules, it's not that difficult. So I would say, like, you know, when you go to a war, you should plan it. And I'm sorry for using those exact words.
Yeah, words. Back something words. We said we're sorry. Not going to talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah. But you know, going and using the technology not the way that, you know, it was supposed to be used will not get you great results eventually. Like, it could, but once you scale, it will break eventually. And once it breaks, it's very painful to fix that. And it's pretty painful also to migrate maybe to another database.
Right.
So I would say, you know, it's not that hard to think about those things when you design your first schema. It's not concrete in stone, so you can always change it, you know, on the fly. So even if you do normalize some stuff, it's all right. But, you know, just be prepared that if you need to denormalize this data, how would you do that? Like, just briefly think about it.
So hold on. So what do you think about, like, the pro? What do you think about, let's say that, let's take the posts and comments example here. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's say that you have a post that has a relationship of one to many comments, right?
Yeah.
And you have your application, you have your blog, and for each post, you populate all the comments from like another collection. And with time, you start noticing, man.
Do you show all the comments?
Do you show all the comments? Let's say that you show all the comments.
Let's say you don't paginate them. Yeah.
Why? I would ask myself why.
I agree with you.
Let's say we started off in a position where
you cannot decouple it with schema design of MongoDB. It's like, if you do something unlogical, like, why do you do that? Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. But yeah, but I'm saying let's go to this example.
Let's imagine that we started off in a use case where typically users don't leave more than like 3 comments on each post, right? And little by little, users add more and more comments. And we come to that point where that post, you know, screen takes a lot of time to load, right? And we're sort of asking ourselves, okay, what can we do? And then we say, you know what? The user doesn't want to see all the comments. We're stupid, right? Let's just show him the last 10 comments. And then we go ahead and we create another property on the post document that's called last 10 comments. And we just, you know, take the last 10 and, you know, embed them inside of the post document, right? It's just a simple script. We just take them, we put them over there, and then
what happens within time when new posts arrive?
So that you would have that problem anytime you would embed anything. So I would imagine that anytime you have a new comment, you would, you know, go to that sort of a post comment created hook.
So right? It doesn't make sense to embed. You've exactly reached the point where, you know, you kind of say, let's embed the last 10 comments within the document. But then you say, well, this data is frequently updated. Then I'll need to constantly like use kind of like, there's a dollar each. So you can actually sort and push out data based on the time within MongoDB. But then you'll need to kind of bounce between, you know, pushing some comments to the comments collection and loading new comments into the you know, into the document, the post document.
Right.
And I don't say it's not feasible. You can use change streams, right? You insert a new comment, you push a new comment to that array, and then the previous array structures can be, you know, captured, and the last one can be thrown into the, but what if something breaks? Then you get with some inconsistent data.
Right.
Some applications might even tolerate, you know, my comment got lost. Okay. Nothing happened, right? But my application runs fast. That's fine. But then you think about like what blocks me from fetching the last 10 comments within the comments collection? Maybe my indexing strategy is not correct. Maybe I need to index the post ID and the date, you know, minus one, which means that, you know, it's a descending order. And then if it's indexed and I'm searching for this post ID and I'm sorting by the, you know, last 10 and I limit by 10.
Right.
So actually going through that index is pretty easy, right? I'm gonna just actually go through 10 keys, fetch those documents and retrieve only those. So now I've solved myself from, you know, maintaining those duplicate data, which is frequently updated. So this is, for example, an example where embedding maybe doesn't make sense. Maybe I just need to use a better indexing strategy for my reference collection. And if you ask those questions, if you ask yourself those questions, like, does this data fetch together all the time? Is it frequently updated? Can we use an extended reference pattern, right? Can we embed some of the fields that are not frequently changed, and the frequently changed ones are, you know, going to another collection? I would say, you know, don't do dollar lookups if you don't must have to do those. So dollar lookup is kind of like a join within MongoDB.
That's what we call populate. That's Mongo's calls a populate.
Yeah. So this is an expensive operation. I mean, it's more expensive than just having it embedded. So if I have like, let's talk about a model of products and, you know, a product catalog, basically. Let's talk about Amazon. So we have users, we have their kind of like their basket, I don't know how you call it, like their
cart,
their cart. Their basket. Yeah. Literal definition. And we have our products. So, you know, so it's obviously that every user will probably have a purchase, and this purchase will have this cart. And it, how many things are you're gonna purchase within one kind of purchase?
Let's say up to five.
Two to five. I don't know if you're 10. I mean, there are probably people that can populate thousands of objects, but those are the outliers. So this is where the outlier pattern is kind of like makes sense. But usually people will buy a small amount of things. So embedding a cart within your, you know, your transaction document or your purchase document makes sense. Does it make sense to embed all the products within that cart? No, because there's no relationship there.
I see.
Doesn't it make sense to have the product as its own collection? Probably yes. But are we going to have a per category collection for like every product? I don't know. That sounds like maybe another anti-pattern where we call it too many collections. So we don't want users to create too many collections. If you need to create thousands of collections, you're doing something practically wrong.
How about dozens?
Dozens is okay. Dozens is okay. Hundreds is, I would say, draw the line around, I would say 500.
I love it how like everything in programming in the end comes down to it depends.
A lot of people use the approach of having multi-tenancy over, you know, databases and number of collections, and they've hit a rock bottom when they've scaled. Mm-hmm. So you need to think about, like, for example, for multi-tenancy, like, does the tenants needs to share data or don't they? Are you going to run reports which are, for example, cross-tenant? you know, running report cross-tenant when you need to join, I know, hundreds of collections doesn't make sense. So you probably should have, like, you know, store them within one collection, or maybe even, I don't know, maybe you have like a collection for huge customers, medium customers, and small customers. And the interesting thing is you can have different indexes on each one of those collections, because, I mean, maybe the small customers, they're doing like very small jobs. Mm-hmm. The big ones actually have like a very unique access pattern. So you can, you could have their own collection, or maybe even their own database, which is probably the same as having their own collection, but maybe they'll have their own cluster. So that's another thing that we can actually, data that we don't need to share between different application users can be actually stored in different databases. And we can have this one metadata database that actually gives us the client that we need to interact with that tenant, for example. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, what do you think about like sort of intermediate documents that just connect between,
like a pivot table?
Yeah, just connect between two documents. Let's say that you have a user and a project.
I think a better thing is like a social media site.
Kind okay.
of. Like a connection between like friends of someone, like if someone befriended someone else, like, is it good to keep kind of only the connection between them, between the two?
Let's say you need some metadata about the connection between them, right? Yeah. Yeah. So is
when
it,
did they become friends? When did they? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
All the kind of Facebooky kind
dates, of blah, blah, blah. So let's say you have like a document that's has like a reference to the user, a reference to, let's say, whatever, another user or project or whatever, and some metadata, like, you know, created it, updated it, you know, blah, 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 all that stuff. What do you think about that pattern?
So you've added this added value. So if the added value of this reference collection, or whatever you want to call it, is, why did my screen get so dark?
Welcome to the...
Okay. I don't know, it's probably auto-tuned to kind of like understand the lighting of the so, you know, if it's only to reference between two relationships, I would say like try to avoid it as much as possible. If it's only to say this is my ID and this is my follower ID and I create those small documents, I don't know if that makes sense. I would go to this outlier pattern where I would have my followers, you know, either I store the amount of followers that I have or the amount of friends that I have within my main document. And then I don't know, maybe I add myself as a friend ID within someone else's, you know, array.
So that would be, so you would just do it on one side in so that like, case.
Yeah. So like my document of myself would have Roman and yourself as like embedded documents of users inside my.
Yeah. Account. Maybe just the IDs. I don't know, because I, or, yeah, maybe just the IDs, like. The,
so an array of IDs.
Yeah, but if I'm growing beyond a certain amount of followers or friends, like if I'm crossing the 1,000, for example, then I'm gonna open another document for storing the next 1,000 followers, and then I'm gonna open another document, but I'm still gonna update the master document with the amount of people. So whenever my application needs to show how many followers do I have or how many friends do I have, then it will have this data in my main document. Mm-hmm. So you'll see I have, I don't know, 20,000. I have 20,000 friends.
Because you know, you have an array of 20,000 IDs.
No, I just have a value in my main document says amount of friends, 20,000. And then the first 1,000 friends are within this document with with an array of their IDs.
So every time you have another friend, you would need to update that value, right?
Yeah, you'll need to update that value and you need to push it within a document. Mm-hmm. And you need to create a new document if you already reached this 1,000 friends. And this is because most people will have less than 1,000 people of friends. And so most of people will actually use one document.
Yeah.
But there are some people who will have 20,000 documents, maybe.
So you're saying about the pivot table sort of idea.
But who's going to scroll through all the 20 million people in your application? Right. No one.
So absolutely.
Fetching all those documents doesn't make sense. So, so this is what I'm saying is that think about the basic information that your application is going to need when you see that page. You're going to need the number of friends. So why not to store this number and update it every time a friend is added, right?
Yeah, but what if you wanted to show like a graph of all the connections you have and kind of so a social network graph, then you'd need those connections and kind of.
Yeah, so a person with 20 million friends, it will load
obviously,
pretty slow for them. But you can say to that person, like, I'm super sorry, we're going to run it on this huge AWS machine. Like, we're going to clone it. We're going to give you whatever you need, probably because you're such a popular user. But most of the people will just fetch this one document and they will have their own, the entire graph.
Okay. I don't want to cut you guys off anymore, but like we should be minded of time a little bit.
Yeah.
We've been going for a while. No, I just to understand your point. So you're saying the pivot table idea is good
only
if you have value. More metadata on the on the relationship, right?
Yeah. If you just store the date that you were friends, where your friends at, then this will probably not going to change. So I would embed that within a document in your, friends array. So if you have things like when the last time we spoke on a chat, or when was the last time that I viewed your page? Yeah, definitely. We're not going to update those arrays within, it doesn't make sense. So let's store it
in a collection.
One of the most, one of the things that this conversation has really,
inspired you.
Yeah. reaffirmed in my mind is that you should always, when you have a sub document, you should always, basically have either an ID to another document or at least a plain object, right? Where you can have room to add another, one more piece of data.
Always do that with MongoDB. You can always, add fields to sub documents. That's pretty easy to do. And we have array filters within updates. There's a lot of capabilities.
Absolutely.
So I would say if you reference data to another place, don't use a value that can somehow change. Use a value
and
that
identify.
Will stick to that. Yeah, stick that to that sense. Thing. For mostly the entire lifetime of this.
Because I tell you what, where we get fucked essentially is where, let's say you have a status field on a document, right? And then the product person tells you, okay, for that status field. So let's say you have user.status and in your document is just a plain string. And then the product person tells you, I want to see, I want to have an expiration date for that status and I want you to show it, right? And then you're like, but fuck, the status is just like a string, field. I need to convert it into an object so I can put another sub, I can need to convert it into a sub document so I can put another sort of field on it. So, that reaffirms.
Or you can add another field called status expiration.
That is true. You got a point there.
Always like.
And this is why MongoDB is powerful. It gives you what's easier for you to do. Have an embedded document, or maybe the status is indexed and now you need to rebuild the entire index to kind of go to an embedded document. So why not to add another field and call it differently?
Yeah,
but if you have this,
Yeah, if you've already done that, probably the better approach would be to just add another field with a prefix of status. But I would say that from the get-go, you should probably, you know, go with the other approach. It would just be easier to add another thing, right? If it's an if it's a sub-document from the beginning, it's easier to add another property than to, you know, that because of what you're saying, right? What if that property is indexed, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, there's some additional, you know, things that we need to address there, but there's no one like thumb rule, like should you have an, like, but you know, you should think, does this gonna change frequently? Is it gonna be extendable? Let's do it as an embedded document. If not, why not to add a prefix a field? Like it'll basically feel the same. So why should we go all the way and do this, you know, huge change where we can add this little change? So,
yeah. Right. Great. Pavel, this was so great. Yeah. I really,
we appreciate you coming by.
We would really love it, you know, to chat with you maybe, you know, in another time. Yeah. And we're going to try and take, you know, a lot of the things that we talked about and try and take that, you know, some of the questions that you talked about and really implement in our day to day. And it would be great if we can talk again, you know, after some time and, you know,
see how you progressed.
Yeah, yeah. See where we got there. And I think, you know, that could be really great. Thank you for your time,
man. Yeah. And is there anything else you kind of want to tell
our 15 person audience?
No, one last thing. I'm working on my own podcast that's going to be, talking about data and different like data aspects, not specifically MongoDB, but just that data world and how it interacts with applications. So I would be very happy to have you there once we kind of, yeah.
Cool, oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've never been a guest on a podcast.
Well,
it's the first time for everything.
Win-win. Yeah. I love this like kind of cultivating podcasting thing that's going on around. It's great. So once again, thank you, Pavel. It's been amazing. And let's talk soon. Peace out, girl.
Bye.
Bye-bye.